Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, upgrading windows to help curb appeal and keep homes efficient. More at callmosby.com.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Sarah Fenske. The new book, The Immortals of Tehran, is set in 20th century Iran. It begins right around the time of the Anglo-Russian invasion of 1941 that forced out one Shah and ends soon after the 1979 revolution that toppled his America-backed son. The story is not, however, primarily of prime ministers and parliamentary intrigue. It's the story of a family, of a poet-turned-politician and his daughters, of his wife and his father and his grandfather and his great-great-great-great-grandfather, and of cats. We'll get to the cats in a minute. The authors of The Immortals of Tehran is an Iranian translator and writer. He was born in Tehran, but for the past 4 years, he's lived here in St. Louis. He's a PhD student at Washington University, and he joins us today to discuss his life and his work. So, Ali Araghi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Ali, your protagonist, Ahmad, he witnesses so much history, but he's not always on the right side of it. What made you decide to make him the center of this story?
So it happened kind of organically. The story is not necessarily the story of one person, Ahmad. It's a, like you said, it's a family saga with a big cast of characters. There's a family tree at the beginning of the novel, and there's like only that family. There are 30 characters on that family tree. So the project was almost to have a large character, a large family, and I can talk about this later in more detail. But I needed to have one major central character, and the story of what kind of that main character became, well, Ahmad actually. So he's a poet, like you said. He witnesses something, and we can go again into some detail. And it becomes interested in poetry and the politics, but it's not specifically about politics and him, but it's about this collective of people.
And he is silent. I guess we would call him mute. And that dates back to something terrible that happened in his childhood. Tell us what happened in that scene. It's very early on in the book, so no spoilers here.
Yeah, this is a kind of maybe topical spoiler, but this is we're going to have to talk about this if we want to talk about the novel, I think. Like you said, this something happens at the very beginning of the book. At the end of chapter one, he witnesses his father's suicide, and he loses his voice for the rest of his life, actually. And he becomes this silent person who witnesses a lot, who experiences life in different ways, and he actually becomes a poet because, I think, in part because of this thing that happens and because of losing his voice.
Mm-hmm. His name, when he first starts doing poetry, he goes by the Silent Fist. I just love this name. Did you draw on anyone in real life with that kind of moniker in inventing this character?
No, the name itself is not historical. I mean, the fact that there were poets used pen names is a historical fact. So there are a lot of poets use some examples that come to my mind is like shadow, like dawn or daybreak or hope. These are like pen names for some very famous contemporary poets in Iran. So this fact that poets use pen names is a historical thing, but and a silent fist is not, I didn't draw it from anyone specifically. So it comes from what happens to him, the way that he doesn't speak, and what happens when he works when he goes to work at the forge. I'm trying not to spoil the novel. The things that happen His fist, his fighting, like there's some fighting that he does, and so it plays some role in picking that name.
I found myself wondering about the role of poetry in Iranian society. It feels like if this novel was set in the US, it would be easy to see your main character being maybe a journalist instead. It feels like poetry in 20th century America didn't always have the impact that other forms did. It was that different in Iran?
In my experience, yes. In my experience of Iranian society and poetry, almost ends 8 years ago when I moved to the U.S. So what I'm telling you is kind of my experience up until that moment. But yes, it seemed to me like poetry in general has a is like more present in society. There are both classical and contemporary. So there's a long line of classical poetry that people are still engaging with. There are a lot of people who read poets like Hafez, Rumi, Ferdowsi. You can still see on social media people post poetry or like comment with a quick line of poem, and there's this kind of funny, interesting custom of like divining using poetry. Like you're undecided about something that you're trying to do. You can't make up your mind. Sometimes people like open the collection of Hafez's Ghazals, and by reading the poetry and kind of interpreting the tone, like what the poem's trying to say, they kind of like try to figure out like what how to make a decision. I'm not saying that like this is a very serious thing, but it's been a tradition and still going on. So yes, it's a very more present type of literary form.
And I know you're very well versed in modern poetry. You edited and translated a compilation of 7 young Iranian poets, bringing those into English. And that book is called "I Am a Face Sympathizing with Your Grief." Is good Iranian poetry, for the most part, available in English if people are really willing to seek it out, or is this something you were trying to rectify with bringing that book to us?
So that book has a story of its own. When I was a little bit before I came to the US, I started this online journal called Perigraffiti, and it was at first dedicated to translating fiction and contemporary Persian fiction into English. A little bit after we started, we added poetry to the magazine too, and we published some Iranian like Persian poetry in English translation. And then after I moved here, I went to University of Notre Dame to study creative writing. I kind of continued to translate, to work on that journal and to translate some poetry. And then when I looked at the kind of repertoire of my poetry translations, and I decided that this could get a little bit more expanded and get could become a little book of itself. So the kind of idea and philosophy behind that was actually looking at the margins of Iranian poetry today and try to find the gems there. So it was like the project was to not look at the center, the people who usually get the spotlight, but actually maybe younger people who are doing great work, but don't get a lot of the spotlight. So that was part of the philosophy behind that. But the thing is that I couldn't get everything that I wanted to because of I had to select some of the poetry that I thought I felt more confident that I could do justice to. I'm not a native speaker of English, and there are a lot of poems that I thought and I still think are really good poetry, but I don't see myself being able to translate them well into English. So this is just a selection of what I liked to have seen in English.
That makes sense. And I can't even imagine the complications of trying to translate poetry. That seems like that's got to be the hardest job for a translator. We're talking today to Ali Araghi. He's the author of The Immortals of Tehran. And Ali, I promised our listeners that we would get to the cats. So I got to make sure we get to the cats. This is a work of magical realism. And for people not familiar with this genre, things happen that seem somewhat extraordinary, but they're almost treated as expected within the book. So, for example, people stick around after they're dead and they communicate and even play in the snow. A poem, going back to poetry, a poem can unlock prison doors. And then there are the cats. So without giving us too much away on this, tell us about the role that cats play in this novel.
So if you allow me, I'm going to give you a very short overview of the whole novel.
Sure.
Before I get to the cats. So there's a family at the center of this novel, and they're apparently under some age-old curse, as a result of which every other son in the family dies young, whereas the other lives as if forever. We follow the life of one of these apparent immortals, like you said, Ahmad, from a very young age to the revolution and a few years after that. So there's a subplot in the novel, like you said, that about cats. And the novel kind of implies that whatever happened in contemporary Iranian history was the doing of cats, not people. So there are a number of things that that came together for these cats to be this central point, locus of the novel. It started with a kind of everyday incident when I was back home. I was walking home. I was on the sidewalk walking home, and I saw a cat. Now, for those people who may not be very familiar with Iran, and specifically Tehran, street cats are a very common thing to see in Tehran. Kind of like squirrels here, with a little bit more character. They're different animals. So you would see them on walls, under cars, in dishes, ripping open garbage bags. But this, usually they run away. They look at you, they eye you up, and if you walk too close to them, they run away. But this one specific cat was walking towards me on the sidewalk, and not even looking at me. It was not even eyeing me up. At that moment, it felt to me that this cat is kind of making a statement, saying that me and you have the same rights to this sidewalk, if not to the city. We're equal citizens. And then kind of the thought kind of snowballs, like, ooh, so what if these cats that I'm seeing every day in the city, what if they're up to something? What if they're not just wandering around? And then again, it kind of snowballs, and it's like, oh, what if they have been plotting, they have been doing something for the whole, for longer than this, for the whole history. So that's one central image that I had that I based the novel on. But go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think any cat lover can identify with that thought. You know, they're so smart and you cannot trust them. They could be plotting revolution.
I have been told that before with, other people have mentioned that. What I was going to say about the cats, if I have time, is that one other thing that the cat subplot is hopefully doing in the novel is kind of bring to attention the concept of historical writing, in the sense that a historical text uses this a very similar narrative strategies as fiction. You take events out of the continuum that is life. You put a beginning to it, put an end to it. You write about one person, a certain event. So there's a theme to this historical piece of writing, and this is something that fiction does. Now, so some of the questions are, what is this frame doing? What is it leaving out of that narrative? Is there something that we're not taking into account? There's something that is misrepresented. So hopefully these cats would raise some of these questions for some of the readers. I mean, I'm not saying that I wrote this novel as a statement about historical writing or history, But so, yeah, I'm hoping people read it and enjoy it. But also, I'm hoping that some people, you know, start thinking about these things.
You're teasing out some important ideas there. And I feel like this novel works on several levels. You can enjoy this saga of this family, but there's also a lot to chew on and think about. And this novel, it's The Immortals of Tehran. You can get it at Left Bank Books. Want to encourage people, you can get your copy there curbside. They are currently open for that. But Ali, I'd be remiss not to talk about in our last few minutes here, you are a PhD student at Washington University. And what made you decide you wanted to study in the U.S.?
So I was a translator in Iran, and by that I don't mean a professional translator. I was an English teacher, so that's how I made my money. And on the side, I did some literary translation, things that I enjoy that I liked. And then a little bit after that, I decided that I wanted to do my own writing. So I started writing short stories, and actually I published a collection of short stories in Iran. And later on, I thought maybe I needed to. So I was thinking how I can dedicate more of my time to becoming a writer. Hmm. And one possibility was applying to creative writing programs, a few in Canada and like I don't know about England, but the majority of them were in the U.S. that I applied to. So I applied twice, and then I came here and studied creative writing at the University of Notre Dame. So yeah, that's how it started. And then after that, I heard about this new program at WashU that they started. It's a comparative literature program, but they started this new track called International Writers Track. Hmm. And so they're you know, quote unquote international writers and poets and translators who study there and do both creative and academic work.
Was it a shock going from the Middle East to the Midwest?
It was a great. It was a big shock because I lived in a huge city of 8 to 10 million mm-hmm. population. I went to South Bend, Indiana, and the timing was not the best because I landed there in December of 2011, and the semester had already ended. So when I went to campus, there was snow and there were some squirrels, and I was like, "Where are people?" So that difference between, so it was like very empty. So yeah, that was a great shock. And then after that, I lived in Ames, Iowa, for 2.5 years, and then I came to St. Louis, and this is the biggest city that I've lived in outside of Iran, and yeah. So I was talking to some of my friends. I've never been to New York. I've never visited New York. I've loved, like everybody gets, especially back home, like, hey, you've never been to New York. But so I've been joking that St. Louis has been like my New York in the States so far.
Well, yeah. we consider that a very flattering reference. We're glad to be your New York. Have you been able to find a community here?
Yes. I mean, the community at WashU has been a good community of friends. For me so far, but I feel like I still need to kind of step out of that the academic kind of my academic community and connect to some people mm-hmm. outside of academia. That hasn't happened to me in the past couple of years because I've always been in an academic environment. That is something that I need to do. And I miss, but this community that I've had has been very helpful and friendly.
Well, hopefully as things continue to open up, you'll be able to do that. I have one last question for you, and that is just your feeling for your native country comes through so clearly in this novel. What is the one thing you find yourself missing most about Tehran or Iran in general?
I think, aside from my family, I guess walking the walking in the streets has been very strangely something that I miss. It's a very walkable city, Tehran is. And I didn't realize that how much I liked doing that until I came here and I found out that no, you can't just walk from place A to like point A to point B, and this is actually something that other people from other, like my friends from other parts of even Europe and other countries talk about also, like how they. You want to walk in a sidewalk full of people, you know, and see life going by. That's something that I really miss.
Boy, I can see why you do. I wish we had that here. But Aliyah Rahaghi, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Ali's book, again, it's The Immortals of Tehran. It's a great read. The Left Bank book has copies, so you can get yours. And we need your help. It's been 20 years since St. Louis's own Nelly released Country Grammar. The album sold more than 10 million copies and achieved diamond status. We'll discuss its impact on Friday's show, and we want to hear from you. Was Country Grammar the soundtrack to your summer 20 years ago? What memories does listening to the album evoke today? Send us a voicemail with your thoughts at 314-516-6397. That's 314-516-6397. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.